Hurricane Katrina brought an entire city to its feet, destroying thousands of homes in its wake. 5 years later, we've heard a lot about what's happened in New Orleans since, but a story that's gone largely untold is the effect the storm has had on the study of hurricanes, what scientists look for, and the breakthroughs that they've had since 2005. I'm very pleased to welcome to today's underreported segment atmospheric scientist James Cossin of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and Professor Judith Curry of the School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Jim, can you give us a sense of what hurricane research was like pre-Katrina?
Yeah, I think historically hurricane research is that's been sort of looked at on a few fronts. There's the big goal of improving operational forecasting, and that sort of research looks at the sort of hourly and daily timescales of how hurricanes behave. And then there's a basic research to try to better understand the physical mechanisms that are at work. You know, why do hurricanes do what they do? Why do they form an eye? Questions like that. And then there's the question of how hurricanes sort of respond to their environment. And within that region, you have a sort of a daily effects. You know, how is the environment changing it today? And that'll expand out to seasonal effects. You know, how is this season going to affect overall hurricane activity? And then you can go off into the climate scale at that point and say, how is climate change going to affect hurricanes, or how do we expect it to? And I think it's in the latter of these that we've seen quite a ramp up of science.
Well, I read something from one scientist who claimed that interest in the whole topic of hurricanes had waned and before Katrina changed everything. Hasn't extreme weather always been fascinating to the public, with movies like Twister and shows like Storm Stories on the Weather Channel?
Yes, I wouldn't say that it's waned. Again, historically, we see a sort of a level number of scientists in the hurricane research business, and you'll get an occasional bump, and those are usually related to a fields campaign that went on and that you know, introduced a lot of new data and a lot of new scientists to the field. I don't think it's waned so much. I think that what you could say is that the tropical cyclone, or the hurricane activity in the Atlantic, went pretty quiet for a couple of decades there. And so that, I think, took it off the radar screen in a broad sense. But it started picking up before Katrina. It really has been quite a bit busier since around 1995.
Judith, one of your colleagues, environmental scientist Roger Pielke Jr. of the Center for Science and Technology Policy Research in Boulder, claimed that the biggest effect on hurricane science since Katrina was its increasing politicization. Do you agree with him?
Well, Hurricane Katrina, combined with two papers that were published at about the same time discussing a possible link between hurricane intensity and global warming, that created a perfect storm for the politicization of the issue. Hurricane Katrina in many ways became a focusing issue for the whole global warming debate. Owing to the dread that people had of something like that happening with a regular basis. Prior to that, people were, 1 or 2 degrees warming, who cares? But all of a sudden, people realized what that might mean in terms of increased hurricane intensity.
But judging from all of the stuff that I get through emails, the debate is still not resolved. Hurricanes or no hurricanes?
Oh, absolutely. It's still the climate dynamics of hurricane, like Jim mentioned a few minutes ago, has really taken off in terms of attracting a whole large number of researchers from diverse perspectives to try to look at the problem. So it's very much an open subject and a very challenging one. We're not going to get definitive answers anytime soon.
You mentioned in a post on the Nature magazine blog that Katrina has resulted in extensive analysis of hurricane data and the development of improved modeling capacity. Can you give us some examples?
Well, prior to Hurricane Katrina, nobody was seriously trying to use climate models to infer future climate, future hurricane activity. But now people are starting to do that using various downscaling techniques that have become increasingly sophisticated over the last few years. And also, we've seen very high-resolution coupled atmosphere-ocean modeling of individual storms, which are helping us better understand how these hurricanes form and intensify, and hopefully will eventually produce better intensity forecasts.
Jim, go ahead.
Of hurricanes.
You mentioned, Jim, that you think that hurricane research since Katrina has become sexy stuff. I mean, for scientists, people want to get into the field now?
Yeah, that's an expression that that I was exposed to quite a bit when I was at Colorado State University, something that Dr. Bill Gray liked to use. And I think that extreme weather in general is going to be more riveting, not just to media and the general public, but also to the scientists themselves. And so, yes, I think Judy touched on this as well, that post-Katrina, there was quite a large influx of talent from a number of fields. I mean, we can get folks who were really doing a lot of work with Arctic ice who looked at the attention that this was getting. They were as focused on it as anyone else. And as scientists, they asked the question, what can I do? What can I look at here? What can I do to help? And I mean, there's actually a fellow who was working on bird migration who experienced Katrina and took an interest in it that way. So I think that there's there's certainly an obvious draw to this sort of thing. I think at the same time, we never want to forget that these are horrendous events that that have a tremendously bad impact across the board. So we always have to sort of be measured about how excited we get about things. But there's certainly lots of motivation to enter the science or continue in it.
So not just atmospheric scientists and meteorologists, but also people from other fields like social scientists and engineers?
Well, that's certainly true. And I think that that's always been the case. I mean, the social scientists have always been there. At least to some extent, I think it's certainly ramped up a lot. And emergency management people, and then there's the political side of that, and that's always been there. Engineers certainly have always been very strongly involved in this, just simply through wind engineering and designing better homes. And, you know, we could certainly go back to Hurricane Andrew and some of the building codes that have been enacted since then in Florida, and that's pre 1995, even when the season started to ramp up. So this has been ongoing for some time. I think certainly things have been galvanized since Katrina, but we don't want to give the impression that none of this was happening previous to Katrina.
My guests are James Cossin, an atmospheric scientist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and Professor Judith Curry of the School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the Georgia Institute of Technology. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I'm wondering about other people, for example, the people who provide emergency services, police and medical. We saw what a disaster their fields were during Katrina in New Orleans. I'm assuming that planning, new ways of planning for hurricanes are being worked out now.
Oh, absolutely. The whole issue of the logistics of managing one of these disasters, everything from the evacuation to getting water to getting power back up and, you know, a whole host of issues are being researched by, you know, engineering teams in conjunction with various emergency management groups, both at the local level and the federal level. There's also a strong increasing interest from the private sector in this. I mean, after Katrina, we saw enormous price spike in natural gas. And after, in 2008, after Gustav and Ike struck, I mean, in the southeast U.S., we were basically without gasoline for almost a month. And so there's a real interest in getting more lead time so they can manage these situations better. Companies like Home Depot, I mean, their whole image is, I mean, if you go to a Home Depot and you can't buy what you need to either prepare or recover from, you know, a hurricane, you know, that hurts Home Depot's bottom line as well as their image. So they need to anticipate where these hurricanes are going to strike to make sure that the stores are stocked correctly. So a lot of city and regional planning going on, trying to optimize you know, these kinds of situations to try to, you know, reduce vulnerability as we prepare for and react to one of these storms.
What about the storms themselves? Are we learning more about how to predict where a storm is going how strong the storm will be?
There's a lot of progress in terms of the track, you know, predicting tracks. Some of the hurricanes are quite more predictable than others. The ones that we're seeing right now, like Danielle and Earl, you could see those coming, you know, 2 weeks in advance, really, from the weather models. But some other ones are less easy to predict. We're making a lot of headway on track forecasts, but intensity forecasts remains very challenging, and there's just a certain element of chaotic randomness that we might not ever capture with the model.
Well, we were told that both of these hurricanes would probably not hit land, but probably. And we've heard that kind of thing in the past, and then a hurricane will suddenly go crashing into Cuba or Haiti. How do we project these things?
Well, there's an issue of what time scale you're talking about. I don't think there's any surprises, say, on the 24-hour time scale anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond 48 hours, you might have some surprises, and beyond 5 days, you can expect surprises. So it's a matter of time scale, and certain storms are just more predictable than others.
Jim, aren't scientists like you predicting that there'll be many storms this season, that there'll be more and stronger hurricanes than last year?
Yes, and that's in complement to what Judy is saying. I mean, what you've been discussing is that day-to-day operational forecasting and some of the challenges, and then if you sort of work this backwards in time, you can get into seasonal forecasting. What scientists look for is precursor signals in the spring and even the preceding winter.
What kinds of signals?
Well, for instance, how warm are the ocean temperatures in the Atlantic itself, in the regions where hurricanes will form, and that has a certain memory to it. So if it's abnormally warm in the spring, it will often lead into abnormally warm waters in the summertime when the hurricane activity really gets going. And there's actually, it's a very complicated system because we even have things that are happening remotely, like the El Nino, which is actually a Pacific phenomenon, and it affects the way hurricanes behave in the Atlantic, and we call that a teleconnection. It's a complicated business, but we can also have some type of prediction for those types of events. So when you put all of these sort of known climate factors into some type of a model and turn the crank, you'll get a sort of a probability out of it of having a busier than normal season.
Did scientists know that 2005 would be a really destructive hurricane season?
Well, the seasonal forecast at that time, and there were fewer seasonal forecasts then than there are now, but they were calling for an above average season, certainly. I think it's safe to say that nobody saw the full extent of 2005 coming. I mean, it broke so many records, and it was such an astonishingly busy season, it's very difficult for this type of statistical model to predict something so extreme as the 2005 season. But they were expecting a busier than normal season that year, just as they are this year.
And weaker seasons in the interim, which is kind of interesting. Judith, there was a study released last week that claimed that rough areas of land, naturally jagged land cover like trees and forests, and even city buildings can actually attract passing hurricanes. Why would that be?
Well, you know, I looked at that paper. I mean, it's a novel idea. I think it needs more investigation before we can have much confidence in it.
So we can breathe a bit easily here in New York?
Well, not really. I would say that they've raised an interesting topic that needs some further investigation. I think the whole, and that there may be other factors as well, the urban heat island, pollution, other things associated with cities that could influence hurricanes one way or the other, in addition to the surface roughness issue. So, again, the paper raised an interesting point. I think it needs a lot more consideration before we, you know, would draw any kind of conclusions from it.
Well, New York has been spared Category 4 and 5 hurricanes pretty much. Is it because of our geography?
Well, you know, when you have a little bit of an indentation, I mean, you know, the North Carolina, Cape Hatteras, you know, that sticks out. That gets hit all the time. Whereas, say, the Georgia coast has sort of that indent, so it doesn't get hit so much. So part of its geography, but New York's been hit before. You're going to get hit again. The issue is whether anything greater than a Category 3 can really make it that far north.
Mm-hmm. They tend to diminish as they move up?
Yeah. You know, the ocean temperatures just get cooler. So I don't think there's any record of anything more than a hurricane, a Category 3 getting that far north. But who knows, that could change.
Well, Earl is moving up the Atlantic. What is the next hurricane? What is the F hurricane going to be?
Fiona.
Fiona?
Yeah. Yeah, Fiona is the next one coming down the pike. It looks like that one has just made tropical storm status. I think it's going to fizzle in the short term, and then we'll have to see if it kicks back up. But at this point, every one of those easterly waves that comes off Africa has been developing since we saw Danielle. That there's another tropical storm, Gaston, that has also just formed. So I don't think we're going to see much from Gaston or Fiona, but there's a big wave coming off after Gaston that might be the one to watch. So,
Jim, a final question. What are some of the biggest unanswered questions that hurricane research still needs to resolve?
Well, I think, again, it's going to depend on which time scale we're talking about. Judy touched on how little progress we've made towards predicting hurricane intensity. The track improvements, hurricane track improvements, have been a real success story, and they've been cut in half over the last 30 years, but the intensity forecasting errors have remained about flat. And so that's certainly a huge challenge to our field, is to improve intensity forecasting. And there's quite a large project right now called the Hurricane Forecast Improvement Project that's ongoing, and this is being addressed with money and with a lot of talent as well. On the seasonal forecasting front, that's always just going to be very challenging, and looking for new signals that might give you some sort of information about what the following year will do. And then, of course, we have significant challenges on the longest time scales in terms of century scale, and trying to understand how tropical cyclones are going to behave under global warming scenarios. And there's so much uncertainty with that right now, but certainly some of the results that have been coming out are certainly alarming. But we certainly have a long way to go before we really truly understand what's happening, or even what has happened. The data suffers from a lot of warts, and it's difficult to get a real good handle on what's happened in the last 100 years as well.
We've been talking about the latest developments in hurricane research with James Cossin, atmospheric scientist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and with Professor Judith Curry of the School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Leonard. Thanks for having us.